It is wonderful to be with you tonight. I want to take time to thank everyone who's been up here, particularly the speakers, the plenaries, the seminar speakers. If anything, it's terribly daunting to follow such great folks. If Scott Wilson is doing his magic, you should see my face on one screen and my PowerPoint on another. It works! The first night I sat in the back to test this thing out, and I realized if you only do PowerPoint in this room, the back two-thirds isn't going to get anything of it, because facial expressions are more important than the slides. But there are some photos and other things I'd like to show that I think will be helpful. There are two big ideas, as you can see in the title of my talk, and they are Missio Dei and The Main Thing. Missio Dei we've been talking about all week, and we'll continue to talk about. It's a broad concept, a meta-narrative, the transcendental vision of the Lord, transcendent vision. It includes all of God's purposes. It's eternal in the terms of redemption and restoration. It's in this world in terms of wholeness, economic justice, racial reconciliation, the environment, health care, ethics, family. Missio Dei includes the poor and the rich, the young and the old, women and men, and all of us. The main thing, the other idea, is different. It is smaller. It's a self-descriptive term, which basically says, as InterVarsity, and I'll apply it, what is our central calling? What is our niche? What is our main thing? On a personal level, we can see in Scripture stories such as Jonah and his call to Nineveh. That was certainly his main thing. Paul, who was called to be an apostle to the Gentiles. The author Peter Drucker has written that the main thing should be 10 words or less. It should be crisp and memorable, and it's not just a gimmick, but it should bring focus and clarity. It's also a vision. Some people call this a vision statement. And that is, it paints a picture of the future. It's action-oriented, it's inspirational, it moves us from here to there. So, what is our main thing? Well, we have three primary core documents. You're familiar with these, I hope. First is our doctrinal basis. The second is our purpose statement. And the third, of course, are our core commitments. Now, what's wonderful about these three documents is they add up to 532 words. And I have a leading role in one of those documents, which Paula Fuller teased us about the other night, that instead of 4 to 6 or whatever you're supposed to have, we have 12, sort of the 12 days of Christmas. It's our thing. Now, our purpose statement comes the closest to the main thing in that it says what we do, that is, we establish and advance witnessing communities at colleges and universities, and it also says what we value, that is, the four loves. But what it doesn't do, nor is it designed to do, it doesn't create a picture of how the world will be changed if we fulfill our purpose. In other words, if we establish witnessing communities all over the place and we fulfill the four loves, how will the world be different? So, let me be bold or foolish, depending on your perspective, and try to give you a less than 10-word version of InterVarsity. There's a hush in the crowd, and everybody's waiting to see what I'm going to step in this time. Now, let me say, this is the caveat disclaimer part, these are my ideas, and I'm not as hung up on these words. These will be wordsmithed. They will go, the cabinet's going to process, there will be lots of discussion. But I wanted to launch the conversation in a bold way. So I'm going to put my draft out there, and I think the concepts are pretty good, all right? Now, what I did with all of these documents I just went through is try to do an InterVarsity thing. I did a word, inductive word study kind of thing, and got out my orange and red pens. No, I didn't quite go to that extreme. But tried to come up with, in summary, in a succinct statement, what is our main thing? I hope you like it. Okay, let's go. The first component, there are three components, that we love God. Any debates on that one? Okay. Whew, safe so far. Second is that we reach the university. Okay, not too controversial. And the third is that we develop world changers. Okay? Now, these are words that are mine. I don't know if they're going to catch on. We'll find out. There are eight words. At one point, I had 11, and I was going to count the hyphen between world and changers as one, and I thought, yeah, I better narrow it down even further. And what we have in these three phrases is the who, that is God, who we love, the where, that is the university, and the what, we develop world changers. The verbs are carefully chosen: love, reach, and develop. And pretty much the rest of my talk is going to focus on these three phrases, so get used to them. You're going to be hearing them for a while. Now, the next question is, how does the main thing of InterVarsity intersect with the Missio Dei? And I was having a conversation with Tom Boyle in my office one day, and I want to give him credit for this. He said, you know, Alec, it's kind of like an hourglass. So I said, that's really cool. Now, let me explain this. Missio Dei takes all of the sand, if you will, of what God wants to do in eternity and in time and pours it, and this is the InterVarsity part, through the main thing, which is the neck. And our main thing is the university world, loving God and developing world changers. And then what's really cool is the Missio Dei occurs through those students and faculty that we send out. So the sand comes in, goes through the neck, and just pours out all over the place. And as we've heard testimonies this week, that's exactly what happened. We invest in students and faculty, and they do stuff that just boggles our mind. And then I started taking this model, and I thought, well, what about the Old Testament covenant? Well, God in chapter 1 of Genesis, Missio Dei, it's big and it's grand. By the time you get to chapter 12, what happens? It narrows to the neck. It's Abraham. God is going to bless the world through Abraham and his descendants. And then it spans out at the bottom. It's cool, isn't it? I like this. Thank you, Tom. All right. And as I thought about my life, and I thought of being a college professor, I thought I'd try to take all of my life experience and all my knowledge of God and all of Missio Dei and pour it into my students. I'm going to tell a couple stories later on about my students and what they're doing out in the world. And what's exciting for me is I put the InterVarsity story together and my own life as a professor. I began to see parallels. Now, notice that this is not a box. If this image were a box, we would be as wide as God. And that's, frankly, the sin of Adam and Eve. They tried to create a box out of Missio Dei. It's humbling to have a neck. It's human to have a neck. We are limited in what we can do. But the grace of God, what Missio Dei can do through us, it's fabulous. And we're going to talk about these three pieces going through. Do you like this? I think it's kind of cool, okay? All right, thank you. Now, I'm going to say something about the university world, which, remember, this is our where in those who, where, and what statements. It is our focal point. It's our slice of Missio Dei. All that we do passes through it. So we are only a missions movement so far as missions passes through the neck of the university. We are only an evangelistic movement so far as it moves through the neck of the universities. Now, I say that with apologies to Harvey Kozart because he kind of spills out all over the place. We are only a social justice movement so far as it moves through the neck of the universities with students and faculty. Over the years, we have blessed other ministries to spin off, including concerts of prayer and Logos bookstores. Some of you are familiar with former InterVarsity staff who have started Servant Partners, which is a post-college urban ministry. It's fabulous. We will continue to send our alums there. But because we pass through the neck of the university, that is the where of our main thing. All right? So now I'm going to move through the three points of these. And the first, of course, is that we love God. Now, there are several documents that I hope you're familiar with, and I'm not going to read them. Our purpose statement, but I just wanted to remind you. And our core commitments. I'll pause while you read them. All right? I mean, it is a wonderful history that we have, that the people who've come before us have said that these indeed, we do it in response to God. We cultivate intimacy with God. It's fabulous. So the foundation of our main thing, before we reach, before we develop anything, we stop to love the Lord. If you recall in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' reaction to those who came to him and said, Lord, didn't we cast out demons in your name Didn't we perform miracles? Didn't we prophesy? And Jesus says what to them? Depart from me, I never knew you, because they didn't love him. That should stop us dead in our tracks. But if we fail in this first step, and if we go to action first, we fail entirely. The game is over. And I confess my failings and struggles in this area. I'm an action-oriented person, and there would be some laughter among the people who know me. And I am learning belatedly to stop, love, reflect first. We've had great speakers this week. Marilyn and Marianne in particular struck me in this vein. And if you're familiar with the Westminster Shorter Catechism, what is the chief end? What is our chief end? That is, what is our main thing as individuals and together? It is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. So what would it look like if we as a community, now I'm talking vision, push it out a little bit, if we loved God the way that we could, if we were wholly devoted and the Lord took us to the next level as a community, well, we would yearn for more intimacy. And I'm going to tell a story of a former student of mine. This is Chan Ong. He was a master's student in a program that I had, and I invited him after he got done with the class. We hit it off to come and to join me in a Bible study. And first time he'd ever picked up a Bible, he spent the whole year going through. And I remember a ways through, I told him that I'd get up in the morning early and I'd sit in my sofa and I'd just look out with my orange juice and I would talk to God. And I explained Abba Father with him and all this. And Chan, the tears started coming down the side of his eyes. And he said, you know, I'm Buddhist, or at least I was brought that up that way. And I go to the temple, I light my candles, and there's nothing there for me. It breaks my heart on the one hand, but it also reminds us of what we take for granted. That in loving God, we have this intimacy. We have this access to the throne, which is absolutely incredible. It's what the world hungers for. I want you to know that over the last 3.5 years since I've been with InterVarsity, the Lord has also been working with me. And one of the key instruments has been this little book by Ruth Haley Barton that some of you went to her seminar. And it's this idea of solitude and silence. It sounds pretty simple, duh. But for type A, action-oriented people, it's really hard. And sitting in the morning and just sitting there silently, it's counterintuitive to me. But for all of us, this is indeed our calling collectively. And I want to ask you a question. Do we as a community yearn for more intimacy? Do we? I hope you're with me on this. I do. Now, as we think about loving God, we also seek to become more dependent. And, of course, as we become more intimate, it's natural that we become more dependent. In the last 3+ years in this role, I've never felt so needy or so dependent in my life. Sometimes when I first came, at least, people would say, Alec, we're really glad the Lord brought you to InterVarsity. It happened a lot when I first came. But my response lately has been, no, I think the Lord brought InterVarsity to me. Because I was in a self-reliant mode. I was comfortable. Bourgeois would be a good term. And the Lord wanted to slap me. And He got me going. And, you know, I think of even conversations where I've messed up, even as late as last night. Those are my mistakes. But the Lord continues to break me and to mold me and to work with me. This whole movement of spiritual formation, which is very grassroots in InterVarsity, it's very, very bottom up. It's fabulous. From the Northwest region to the Southeast, from the Pacific to the Northeast, there is something going on among us. God is doing a work, creating more intimacy, but also breaking us and making us more dependent. I have a great photo here of the San Diego division. I hope they all don't go nuts here. There's a couple over to the left, I think, that's a little too affectionate, but that's the Pipers. But for the last almost 5 years, for 3 times a year, for 48 hours, they get together. Douglas Marilyn Stewart started this, and now Steve Stuckey, the tall guy in the back row, leads it. And the results have been a greater intimacy, a greater dependency. The byproducts have been a deeper passion for evangelism because they're in touch with the living God. The fire is in the belly. And there's less burnout, and they're more harmonious. How obvious, how obvious. And there it is. So the question I have for you again is, do we want to become more dependent on the Lord as a fellowship? Do we? Yes. I certainly want to. And one final aspect of loving God, and that's remaining steadfast. When I became a Christian, it was all pretty positive. I knew the soft side of the faith, forgiveness, indwelling of the Holy Spirit, hope. It was pretty cool. But then I learned there's a hard side to the gospel. Rejection by peers, taking up one's cross. And I think you're probably all familiar with this passage in John 6. Many of his disciples said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it?" And from this time on, many of the disciples turned back and no longer followed him. "Do you want to go away as well?" Jesus asked the 12. Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the word of life." And I honestly didn't know what videos were going to be shown tonight, and I didn't know the Ohio State testimony was going to be given tonight, but it was a perfect lead-in and feed-in to what I want to read a quote from another IVP book, the second one here. And this is, I really recommend, it was cited by someone else, but tolerance is the new gospel of campus life. And this is the quote from a Welsh writer. "Unfortunately, the term tolerance has recently become badly debased. Where it used to mean the respecting of real, hard differences, it has come to mean instead a dogmatic abdication of truth claims and a moralistic adherence to moral relativism. The new intolerant tolerance might better be described as an anti-value. It is a disposition of hostility to any suggestion that one thing is better than another." And it's that last sentence that really caught my eye. Because it's this one thing that we do, whether it's on campus, in our books, in our conferences, in our camps, is we suggest that one thing is better than another. Matter of fact, we say that one thing is eternal truth. We say it's absolute truth. Well, what kind of reaction is the gospel of tolerance going to give us when we say that? I want to quote a letter to bring it to campus that I got a year or two ago from Central College in Iowa. And by the way, our staff were brilliant in the way they handled this. It was a situation where one of our second-level student leaders declared a position that was outside the bounds of biblical social ethics or sexual ethics. And as a result of that, he also happened to be the student body president of the school. A letter was circulated among 17 faculty and staff. And it read something like this: "InterVarsity promotes a culture of moral judgment, is fundamentally anti-intellectual in nature," IVP, take that, "denies the right of every individual to feel safe and respected, and marginalizes some members of the community." Well, I don't know about you, that doesn't make me feel real good. And when we talk about loving God, it's not all the fun, easy stuff. It's the hard stuff, too. It's remaining steadfast in the face of adversity. I don't like being called narrow-minded, simplistic, holier-than-thou, homophobic, bigoted. But you know what? In the gospel of tolerance, in the gospel of Jesus Christ, we're going to get called names. And we have to remain steadfast. In context, though, you know what? We have it a whole lot easier than Iraqi Christians today or Japanese Christians in the 16th century. I mean, we still got it easy, but we got to be steadfast. So my question to you, do we as a movement want to remain steadfast in the Lord? Do we? Amen. Let me move on to the second aspect of the main thing, and that is reach the university. I tried to find a verb that worked. I think this is about as good as I got when I got to this place. I like it because it's a bold statement. We are no longer trying to establish beachheads at universities. We are in our seventh decade. Our vision is to permeate every crack and crevice of the university world. Now, there may be cracks and crevices that are already reached by other ministries. Fine. Let's go after the unreached crack and crevices. Now, the question is, why the university? And maybe that doesn't need rehearsing here. Maybe we all know why the university. But let me give you why I think the university is so compelling. It's compelling because we see the Apostle Paul, when he went to Athens, where does he go? He goes to the Areopagus, because as John Stott says, that's the equivalent of the university in the Greek world. Why is it compelling? Because of all things he could have chosen, the former United Nations General Secretary said, change the university and you change the world. It is the hinge, it is the strategic point on which you can change the world. Why is the university compelling? Because only 25% of Americans graduate from their undergraduate institutions. And these will become the leaders in business, in the world, in government, and because of America's position, at least for now, in the world. It's compelling because, as I had lunch with James Emery White, our speaker this morning, he said there are three places where culture is formed today. The first is the media, the second is the legal system, and the third is on campus. And as I thought about that statement, the first two are subsumed in the third because it's our students who are going to go out and do the other two. So if I had to invest my life, where would I want to invest it? As a matter of fact, I want to tell you a little bit about my story. I was 25, 2 years through law school, and my wife and I went off on a five-month honeymoon through Europe and the Middle East. Okay, I had to throw that in. But on that trip, I was going, Lord, you called me to law school, and I'm going to finish in a year. I don't want to be a lawyer. I had two jobs. Now, that's another story I'll tell you sometime. And the Lord began to talk to me, and I began to feel a pull in my heart, a yearning for the university world. I came back, and while I was still in law school, found a part-time teaching job. And during the next five-plus years, I worked for World Relief, and the Lord taught me a lot working with refugees. And we resettled 1,000 refugees a year in a five-state region. It was a fabulous, and it changed me. But always was this hunger for the university, this passion for it. And eventually, they hired me. It was amazing. And after 7 years of an adjunct instructor, they hired me. And I remember going to a conference, talking to other deans at other universities, and they said, that's an unprecedented route to go from a 7 years like an indentured servant. But I really, really wanted in the door, and the Lord honored that. Now, one question in this verb, reached. What would a reached university look like? Well, I think a reached university would be a place where every student and faculty has a relational contact with a follower of Jesus. I think a reached university would be a place where Christian ideas are part of the public discourse on a regular basis. I think a reached university would be a place where witnessing communities incarnate the values of Missio Dei. Now, I'm going to look at some documents here the lawyer in me has to get out the documents. Okay, bear with me. The purpose statement, I mean, this should be a no-brainer. You should all have these memorized. And, of course, the very first of our core commitments is the college and university world. Now, let me go back to the hourglass. And just to catch up where we are, because I'm going to come back to this three times. This is my second time. Missio Dei, all of God's purposes, and our main thing is that we love God, we reach the university, and we develop world changers. In this context, we're talking about the university. So I've amplified a little bit, and you can do that in the subtext when you're doing main things. It's sort of an asterisk at the bottom. And I want to propose that we reach every group on every campus. And so I want to take a minute to talk about every group, and then I'll take a minute to talk about every campus. We have some campuses where the best thing to do is to have a whole campus approach to it. And one of my favorite stories this fall occurred at Northern Illinois. Wherever you are, you might clap. And this is Sujo John. He's not a staff member. He's a fellow who survived 9/11. He was on the 81st floor of one of the Twin Towers. And he's now an evangelist. But the story behind the story is that before he came, our staff and students spent weeks fasting and praying. 10 student evangelists were trained. There was regular, just really people put, and they worked with the professors to get students to come. It was in the newspaper. 600 students came to the event to hear this fellow speak, and 107 came to faith that night. Now, that's reaching the university in its whole sense. But as we know, and we are very missiologically creative people, I know you out there, we also work with subgroups. And I'm going to do this alphabetically. The first The first subgroup, if you will, are affinity groups. And there are so many affinity groups on campus. I mean, it's incredible. There are 750,000 Greek students on American campus. Yeah, I don't get a little bit that way. There are gospel choirs at so many of our schools. And I look at what's happening at DePaul, and I think, this is such an avenue where we could go. Alex Anderson had a passion for this. It is an exciting ministry. I think of dorms, just basic dorms. You know, and a lot of you, my daughter's a freshman in college. Her dorm is her affinity group. That is it. So if she's going to be reached, there's a sense in which she would need to be reached in that dorm. And one of the stories I like, a couple of years ago, some upper division students moved back in the dorms at Nevada, at Reno, and they hung around with freshmen. You know, that's a real sacrifice. And by the end of the year, 15 freshmen had become believers. We could, I mean, replicate that. Athletes, you know, there are other ministries doing athletes, but we do athletes too at Delaware. So, and the nice thing about athletes is you get an affinity with some Christians, and they introduce you to all their friends. And you can do stuff in prayer with them that you might not. It's like gospel choirs. You kind of have an excuse to be Christian. It's kind of cool. Another subgroup or subgroups would be by ethnicity. There are 2 million African-American students in the United States, 1.5 million Latino, 1 million Asian Americans. And of course, there are a lot of Native Americans, South Asian, that is Indian, for example, and 11 million Caucasian students. I mean, we are, again, missiologically creative. We'll do whole group, we'll do small group, we'll do niche group. We just want it to work. We want the gospel to get out. A third set of subgroups would be by major. And as you know, we have Nurses Christian Fellowship. It's been with us for a long time. But we also have art students. We have art ministries. We have engineering. I mean, there's a lot of these kind of groups. And finally, by national origin. And I want to show, this would be the international students. We still have, after 9/11, we still have 550,000 international students in this country. And you talk about developing world changers, this is a pretty good place to start. And I want to show you a picture of Bo Wang. Bo is a postdoc student at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, who Terrell Smith set me up with, and we studied the Gospel of John this last fall. Bo's about 35. He's going to be a very important person back in China. And when we got through parts of John, he was so close. It was just that matter of will. And now he's moved to Michigan. That's the bad news of the story. He got another postdoc there. The good news is Terrell got on the phone with our staff member there and just referred Bo on. So Bo is not going to escape us. I mean, we're just going to continue to pursue him. Now, there are also 2 million grad students. 2 million grad students in the U.S. And in some situations, some campuses, we go after the whole campus. This is a picture of Stanford. And I wish you could see the third row, fourth person over. She has her tongue out. She didn't know that she was going to be put up on a picture with 1,300 people looking at her. But she's a Stanford graduate student. But we also have, and I think you know this, but it's exciting, an unlimited amount of discipline-specific niche groups. Law students, medical students, business students, health administration, veterinarians, theology, and the list can go on and on. The final group that I want to mention is faculty. Faculty are in our purpose statement. There are 600,000 faculty in the United States, 600,000, and they need the Lord. Groups like at MIT, where faculty are reaching out and bringing in their peers, is an evangelistic effort on faculty to faculty. But I also think that we need to think of faculty more as a resource for students. We underutilize our faculty. They are mentors, they are advocates, and they are witnesses. I love this ad that appeared in the University of Maryland student newspaper in December. I can't believe it. Now, you can't read the fine print. The names down below are 30 faculty and staff who give their departments and their email addresses saying Jesus is the Messiah. These are faculty and staff. And I, at a public university, I mean, I almost wept when this came in my email. It's absolutely fabulous. Now, what is our motivation in all this? Is it that I simply am ambitious and want to go to every crack and crevice, megalomania gone mad kind of thing? No, I think it's the gospel. And let me, you're familiar with this passage in Matthew 9. I'm going to paraphrase some things as we go through it. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, put in parenthesis, colleges, universities, and institutes, teaching in their synagogues, in parenthesis, say classrooms, dorms, preaching the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness. When he saw the crowds, read students, faculty, staff, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. And then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few." A familiar passage, but I hope that it just builds our faith and our desire. Do we want to reach every unreached group on campus? Do we? Yes. Yes, we really do. Now, let me talk. I said every group on every campus. Let's talk about every campus. There are so many different types of campuses that we work with. And now, I'm going to do something a little risky here. I'm going to mention some campuses that we're not on. And so I'm getting ADs and RDs and NFDs all kind of riled up here. And we have a task force to help clarify where we want to grow. These are just random, okay? So don't take them seriously. I'm just dreaming a little bit here, all right? So dream. Thank you. Okay. I got permission from somebody in the fifth row back. I'll take that as an affirmation of all of you. We are at Colorado Liberal Arts Colleges. We're at Colorado College. What would it take for us to get to Carroll College in Montana? Comprehensive universities. We're at the UT Austin. What would it take for us to get to the University of Arkansas? Catholic universities. We're at Georgetown. What would it take us to get to Xavier? We're at HBCUs. We're at Shaw. What would it take for us to get to Fisk, the alma mater of W.E.B. Du Bois? Latino-serving institutions. We're at UTEP in El Paso. What would it take for us to get to University of Texas Pan American? Those schools with high Asian American presence. We're at Northwestern. What would it take for us to get the University of Hawaii at Hilo? I see any volunteers? Yeah. I had a feeling, you know, I hadn't really planned, but as we talk, take me, Lord, send me. Yeah. It's not being served as far as I know. It's open. You know, of course, then again, your AD and RD are going to kill me for suggesting this. Tribal schools. We have students at the Southwestern Indian Polytechnic Institute. I knew that was going to be a mouthful. Now, what would it take for us to have students at the Saginaw Chippewa Tribal College in Michigan? Commuter schools. Cal State Dominguez Hills. And what would it take for us to be at Cal State Long Beach? Incidentally, that's where my brother teaches. Let's put something on his back. Community colleges. We're at Rochester Community College in Minnesota. What would it take for us to be at Central College in St. Paul? And finally, institutes. We're at the Ringling School of Art and Design in Florida. What would it take for us to get to the Art Institute of Atlanta? Again, I mention all of these things because I think God calls us to our main thing. And this is our main thing. You know what's really encouraging to me about this talk? I thought, oh, Lord, Missio Dei is big and the neck is narrow. But you know what? The neck has 16 million students and 600,000 faculty. Wake up. It's a big neck. You know, let's claim the neck. You know, currently, that's going to get translated out of context. I can hear that one. Go for the neck. We're currently reaching... Well, we got a president who goes for the jugular. He wants to conquer the neck. We're currently reaching 565 campuses. That's about 25%. What would it be like a decade from now if we dream a little bit, if we really wanted to reach campuses, if we were on 800 or 1,000? We're reaching 33,000 students. A decade from now, why not 50,000, 60,000? We're reaching 1,200 faculty. I really like the way Stan Wallace thinks. He's got, I'm going to be modest with his numbers. Why not 8,000 or 10,000? This is not growth for growth's sake. This is because of our calling. This is our mission. This is what we do. We push forward because we love God, we love students, and we love faculty. Do we want to reach more unreached campuses? Do we? Yes. Thank you. Well, let me move to the final of the third part, third component, the what of the three that we do, and that is we develop world changers. And when I wrote this, I thought, gee, that sounds arrogant. We develop world changers. We're really cool. And then I thought of Scripture. You look at the Old Testament and college-age students who went out and changed their world, Daniel and Esther. How many sermons have you all preached on them? In the New Testament, Timothy, Mark, John. Does it sound arrogant to develop world changers? Think of church history. John Huss, John Wycliffe were young when they felt their call. The Haystack Movement in 1806, which is coming up on 200 years, students. And the student Christian movement in the late 1800s sent 20,000 student missionaries overseas. 20-year-olds were carrying the gospel where adults had failed to go. So is it audacious? Does it sound arrogant? I tell you, it's the gospel. It's what we do. Now, some of the documents, because, you know, I'm going to go back to documents. Okay, hang in there with me. Our purpose statement and our core commitments say this is what we do. What we do with leadership development. What we do with whole life stewardship. What we do with missions. We develop world changers. Now, this is subtle. We aren't changing the world. We're changing the world changers. And that's a really important distinction. We pour our lives into students and faculty, and they change the world. So let me go back to the hourglass. Last time, I said three times, this is the third one. And this is where it all kind of comes together in kind of a cool way. All the sand of the Missio Dei pours through the neck of, certainly not all the sand of the Missio Dei pours through our neck, but the sand pours through our neck, and then it pours back out, and it changes the world. The amazing things that our alumni are doing, the staff, and what I'm going to finish with is what I'll call the Magnificent Seven. And these are seven alumni who, in quiet ways and in bold ways, are making a difference in the world. This is why we do what we do. It's these kind of people. So let me tell their stories in a brief way. The first we heard from this morning, James Emery White. Weren't you proud? Here's a guy who became a Christian through InterVarsity, went to Urbana, went to our camps, is an IVP author. When I talked to him about a month ago, I said, Jim, you're a poster child for InterVarsity. You know, can we use you? And we had lunch today, and he said, use me all you want. He says, I owe a debt that I could not repay to InterVarsity. It was a wonderful conversation. The second is a woman named Nellie Escalante Dunberger. Nellie is a graduate of Hunter College, where her CSM was a handsome young man named Orlando Crespo. And Orlando says that she came to campus. She was Pentecostalist and wore a dress to school every day. Had a good heart for God, but had a little bit of, you know, getting outside the tradition here. She got involved with the exec, was small group leader, regional LaFay conference, planning group, etc. You may notice her last hyphenated part of her name is not Latino. Well, her husband's Jewish, and they were good friends, and because of her, he came to the Lord. So now she got a hyphenated Latino-Jewish name, which is kind of cool. And her husband's a social worker in the Bronx. Nellie teaches at the City of the University of New York in the Bronx. She teaches art history. And she's also an educator of the Museum of the Moving Image. At her church, she's the volunteer college career ministry coordinator. Yeah, it just kind of goes on and it gets better here. They've made a choice to commit to the Bronx, to stay there, even though they've had plenty of other opportunities, and they have an autistic child. And, you know, this is a story, who knows who Nellie is, but God knows. And she and her husband are making a huge difference in the lives of people. They are world changers. The third is my friend Vladimir from the Ukraine. This picture was taken at World Assembly about a year and a half ago. He's the general secretary in Ukraine and just promoted up to become the associate regional director for Eurasia. His conversion story ties into my own life in a way. And it's like this. One of my students at Seattle, named Monica Noonan, who now works at Microsoft, was 20 or so years old and went on an InterVarsity global project. And she went to the Ukraine with all of those students. Some of you remember this. A lot of students went to the Ukraine, and they did English, and they did evangelism. And one of the converts of one of those ESL programs was Vladimir's best friend. And Vladimir became a believer through the best friend. Today, the Ukrainian movement has about 30 staff and volunteers. And the reason this story is so compelling to me is, of course, it's been in the news. And the whole political situation with the election and the fraud and the people in the streets, our students, our brothers and sisters, were there in the square with a tent. It was a prayer tent. They were handing out socks and soup. And they were praying, and they were working with people. But there's even, I think, a more significant story. And that is one of our alums, or one of the Ukraine, I say our, but one of our IFES alums, was a lawyer. And he happened to be the lawyer who argued the case before the Ukrainian Supreme Court that the election was fraudulent. And the evening before, this is what you may not know, the evening before he was going to be arguing this, he had one of our staff workers, Ukrainian staff workers, come in, and they spent up all night praying, drinking coffee, and going over the arguments. And when that decision came down, I was absolutely shocked, I must confess. I've spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe. It was a stunner. And what I want you to do is follow this pattern. A 20-year-old named Monica Noonan, and people like her, go to the Ukraine for 6 weeks. Somebody meets Jesus. Somebody is a friend of Vladimir. Movement starts spreading throughout. Students are touched, graduate students. They go to law school. They get in places of influence. And a corrupt election is overturned, and world history has changed. Years ago, a professor of mine wrote a book called The Mustard Seed Conspiracy, and that's what this is. The next world changers are Oliver and Valerie Johnson. Oliver went to Chico State, and his first fellowship group was a Christian Science group. That was not good. And he said InterVarsity rescued him. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Went on to grad school at Clark Atlanta and met Alex Anderson and Tony Warner. He now serves at Holy Cross Services in Michigan, and he's working on his second PhD. His first PhD is in social work. His second is in counseling. His wife, Valerie, went to Georgia Tech, graduate, went to Urbana 76, met Oliver as she was volunteering at the Atlanta chapter, and now works doing IS for Detroit Edison. She's active in her church, and she leads a weekly Bible study. Imani, the great part about this story is their daughter. Their daughter, Imani, is a senior at Clark Atlanta. She's the chapter VP in InterVarsity, and she wants to go on to get her doctorate in clinical psychology. And even though their story is not as dramatic as the one I just told, they are world changers indeed. Now, I have three more to go. Hang in there. This is fun. Jimmy Lee, University of Illinois, small group leader, large group coordinator, Cedar Campus all 4 years. John Rockman, where are you? He loves you. John came by to see him every week. Comes from a non-Christian family. He's currently the executive director of Chinatown Chamber of Commerce. He's been an assistant to the governor for Asian American Affairs, and he's just been named to the White House Advisory Commission for Asian Americans. He's touted as a real future leader in Republican politics in the state, and he's 27 years old. I might add he's also single, and if there's any... I told him that if any referrals come out of this, I get a finder's fee. But Jimmy leads, he volunteers at his church with the Chinese Christian Union, and is changing lives. All right, down to the final two. Mike McIntyre, four-term U.S. congressman from North Carolina, Democrat. You notice how I had to do that. I did the Republican, now I did the Democrat. Jimmy Long was his CSM, met with him weekly. When Jimmy was young, this goes back a ways, chapter president, small group leader, camp leader. His calling, I think like Jimmy Lee's, is to government service. His best friend, as Mike was the president of the Young Democrats, the best friend was the president of the Young Republicans. They went to law school together and were partners in law together. Mike is an elder in his church, leads prayer meetings, is involved in the Capitol Hill, speaks at chapter meetings occasionally. And in the conflict with the USC, the video you saw, Mike was there behind the scenes. Nice to have friends in high places. The two young men in this picture are his sons, one of whom's the MC for the large group, and the other is on the exec. world changers. And I want to finish my last one, Ivan Lumala. Ivan's not an InterVarsity student. He's mine. And I want to tell you a little bit about him because I want you to see the consonance of my life with the main thing of InterVarsity. I met Ivan when he was 20 years old in a small group in my basement. He was a junior, and he had been slated to be a mechanic in Uganda, but was able to be a chaperone with the African Children's Choir. And that started a friendship that has lasted 20 years. After he graduated, about a year later, he called me and said, "Alec, I'd like to get together with you regularly." So for 4 years, every other Saturday, Ivan would come over at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning. We would read and pray, and then he'd play with my kids for about an hour and a half. He loved our family, and Ivan became part. When he goes to Washington, D.C., next month, he'll be looking up our daughter. As you see from the picture, he's married, has now 4 children. There's a child not in this picture. The boy in the picture is adopted. There's a lot of AIDS, as you know, in Africa, and a lot of death in the family, and they've taken on. But where I really wanted to tell the story about Ivan, and it's a nice way to wrap up, is that today Ivan works at Microsoft. A lot of my former students worked at Microsoft. And he supports 19 nephews and nieces back home, and they're going to school. But the real story I wanted to tell you was just before I left, he came to me and he said, "I would like to start a foundation to bring African students to the United States." And it was creative. He said, "I'll raise a third of it. I'll give or raise a third of it. Microsoft will match it. And then I want to go to colleges and say, will you provide a third scholarship?" This year, there are 5 students. I mean, and Ivan's not 40 yet. You know, he's probably about turning about 40 now. And where the story really ties in for me is he told me in a phone call last week that a Ugandan student who's at Oregon State University, part of one of these 5, went to some kind of camp on a weekend somewhere in Eugene and really liked it, and the people were cool. And, of course, it was an InterVarsity chapter camp. And I thought, "Lord, how good of you to tie the ends of my life up in this way, to see Ivan, who was going to have a life that was going to be difficult, changing lives and being a world developer in his own right." So is it in our heart? Do we want to develop more world changers? Do we? Yes. Thank you. I've gone too long. I hear the rabbits scurrying down below my feet. But I wanted to say this, and I wanted to say it with passion. I want to say it with illustrations. Our main thing is in the context of Missio Dei is that we love God, we reach the university, and we develop world changers. This is a call that is compelling. This is a call of worthy to give our lives to. Let me pray. Father, we are humbled by your call. We are unworthy. I am unworthy. I know that. And yet, Lord, you call us to yourself. You call us to the campus. And you call us to invest in lives of students and faculty that they might change the world. Oh, God of heaven. Oh, God. Clean out the sin in our lives. Clean out the junk so that we can be clean vessels, that you can work through us. Forgive us when we fail you, because the vision, the dream is so big, 16 million students, 600,000 faculty. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.